A South Dakotan takes the top seat in the U.S. Senate. Another South Dakotan rides to the border and into the inner circle of America's next president. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, November 20th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we get a state history lesson from Tony Venhuizen of the SODEC Governor's Blog. We'll ask what's next for Lieutenant Governor Larry Roden and put the recent state political news in context. Our Dakota political junkies explore John Thune's rise to power. We'll discuss what America knows about how he leads and what we're about to find out. Plus, we remember Gordy Pratt, the musician, comedian, and fabulous one guy, passed away last week. He was 71. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. As you've probably heard, President-elect Donald Trump wants South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem to join his cabinet as America's Homeland Security Secretary. If appointed, Noem would step away from South Dakota, allowing Lieutenant Governor Larry Roden to become the state's next leader. That transition would most likely take place during the 2025 legislative session. Tony Venhuizen writes the SODEC Governor's Blog. He stopped by the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls with a lesson on several firsts in state political history. Let's talk a little bit about the timing.
Yeah.
The budget address. Will she give the state of the state address? What do we know about her confirmation? Can we go over some of that so people just have an idea of what to expect in the next really 3 months?
Yeah, and some of these are open questions, and I'll do the best I can to say how I think it's going to work, because it is interesting. We've had two other times where a governor has left office midterm. Dick Knipe resigned to be ambassador to Singapore the summer of his last year in office. Of course, Governor George Mikkelsen died in a plane crash April of 1993. What's different about this is a transition that will happen, it appears, during the legislative session. It makes for an unusual situation, but her nomination has been announced by Donald Trump. He is not the president until he's sworn in on January 20th, which means he can't officially nominate anyone until he's sworn in. I mean, he's sworn in at noon. He'll go back, you know, sign a bunch of these things that same day, but none of those nominations technically happen. Now, the U.S. Senate, the new U.S. Senate, convenes January 3rd, and they have said that they are going to start holding confirmation hearings prior to January 20th for some of these cabinet picks. And I happened to see an article interviewing Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who's going to be chair of the Homeland Security Committee, in which he specifically said that it's his intention to start on the hearings for Kristi Noem after the 3rd, with the goal of having it done by the 20th so that she could potentially be confirmed and sworn in shortly after President Trump on the 20th or 21st. Now, what's that mean for South Dakota?
Right.
Of course, she's still the governor sitting here today. We have a budget address on December 3rd. That is always delivered by the governor, and I have every reason to assume that she will present that as she always would. It's not unusual, actually, to have the outgoing governor do that. Governor Dugard did that December before he left office. That's kind of a longstanding practice, and it's, in a way, functions as a farewell address for the departing governor. And this is a budget that she will have been working on preparing even prior to getting this appointment. So it is, to a large extent, her budget. The more interesting dynamic is our legislative session starts the second Tuesday of January, which this year is the 14th. It's as late as it can go. Donald Trump becomes president on the 20th, and she presumably would be confirmed shortly after that. We very well may have a situation where our first week of the legislative session, Kristi Noem is still the governor. That state of the state address is the first day. If she's the governor, I would think she would deliver that address. But then second week of session, we come back. The Monday of the inauguration is Martin Luther King Day, so it's not a legislative day. But by the time we come back for the second week of session, she may have resigned and Larry Roden takes over as the governor. So an unusual circumstance. Not a problem, I don't think, but unusual.
Not inconceivable that she could be in Washington and we could see Larry Roden give the state of the state as well, if they're planning on starting confirmation hearings potentially before the official nomination. So that's up in the air, which means she has to plan the budget address. It might be her last one.
It could be the budget address. And, yeah, I haven't heard any plans that she wouldn't deliver the state of the state. But the state constitution says she can delegate any duties to the lieutenant governor. So that would be within her authority if she wanted to.
Okay. So a lot of history happening there. There's a little bit about how it works. And then from a how it works standpoint, current Lieutenant Governor Larry Roden gets to appoint his own lieutenant governor.
That's right.
And he would do that when? Again, this is all presuming she gets confirmed, which seems quite favorable to her, but we don't know what's going to happen. So he would appoint somebody, and what would the timing of that be?
Yeah, it does appear that she's going to be confirmed. Her appointment doesn't seem to be attracting much controversy, so I do think that's a fair assumption. If the lieutenant governor steps up and becomes governor, there's a vacancy for lieutenant governor. The governor appoints a replacement subject to confirmation by a majority vote of both houses, the House and the Senate. So I have to assume, I don't have any inside knowledge of this, but I have to assume Lieutenant Governor Roden has already given this some thought. He knows at this point that this is a near certainty that he'll need to make this decision in the next couple months. I don't know when he would announce his choice. I would think he would wait until Governor Noem had resigned and he had stepped into the governorship and then make that pick. The nice thing is, because the legislature is in session, once he makes that announcement, the legislature can take action on it right away. There's no need to call a special session. When Governor Mickelson died, there was actually a special session held several weeks later to confirm a new lieutenant governor, but that wouldn't be necessary in this case.
I looked back at your writing when Governor Noem was running about some of the predictions and likelihoods and unlikely things that she might decide before we knew Larry Roden was going to be her chosen lieutenant governor. Have you put any thought into geography? Is he from the ag industry? Male, female, age? Some of those things that would be a good lieutenant governor pick for Larry Roden. What are some of your initial thoughts there based on how you were sort of looking at Governor Kristi Noem, then candidate, saying, this is who I'd like to run with?
Yeah, and of course, that's all very speculative. But you know, some factors I think are pretty obvious. Lieutenant Governor Roden is from West River, Union Center, a very small town. In fact, I think probably it would be the smallest town to ever be the home of a sitting governor, a rancher. You have to think if he's looking at a balance, I think it's very strong chance he would look East River, perhaps Sioux Falls, and probably he and Governor Noem, I know, have been proud of the fact that they're both ag producers. Unusual to have the governor and the lieutenant governor both come from that farm ranching background. So perhaps he'd look for somebody in that field, but if he's looking for more balance, he could look for somebody in a different field also. You know, man or woman, I think I wouldn't guess one way or the other. Age, Larry Roden will be on the older side. He'll be, I think, almost 66 when he takes office. I'd imagine he'd pick somebody younger than that, but that doesn't narrow it down much.
You need someone with good knowledge. This person will be president of the Senate. So would
I think that's really goes more to the point is you can look at these demographic balancing things, but really what does he need? He needs a governing partner. He needs somebody he knows and trusts and is comfortable with. This person has to preside over the Senate, which is important. You want someone who can do that. But even more important is somebody who can be part of the administration, contribute to that job, and then, of course, be ready to step in why do we have a lieutenant governor?
Right.
We're experiencing it right now. If something happens to the governor, you need somebody who's ready to step in. So if you're Larry, you want somebody who's ready to step in for him. That's why you pick it.
Yeah. There might be room in a future administration for Larry Roden to leave the state. There are all kinds of political speculative things that might happen. So that lieutenant governor position is not a filler. That is a person who should be able to serve as governor.
And we've seen that. Everyone has known for a while that there was a possibility that if Donald Trump won, that maybe there'd be a place for Kristi Noem, right? It's surprising when it actually happens, but we all knew this was a possibility. But I'm old enough to remember, and you are too, when George Mickelson died, that was just a thunderbolt. Nobody saw that coming. And so that's why we have a lieutenant governor. Any day at any time, this can be very important.
So from what you know about Lieutenant Governor Roden, he will make that decision very thoughtfully.
I'm sure.
Let's go back to some of the historic aspects of this. Governor Kristi Noem going to Washington. That's the first time that's happened from South Dakota, that a governor's left to be a presidential appointee. Tell me a little bit about governors. We mentioned the governors who have left early, but how many have gone on to be national cabinet members?
We've never really had a South Dakotan become a member of the president's cabinet.
Okay.
So assuming she's confirmed, she'll be the first. There was a Secretary of Agriculture in the 1940s in the Truman administration, whose name was Clinton P. Anderson. And he was born and raised in Centerville, but then left the state, had lived in New Mexico. He was a congressman from New Mexico, member of Truman's cabinet. I would consider him to be a New Mexican at the time he served, not a South Dakotan.
Okay.
Very much like Hubert Humphrey was a vice president from Minnesota, even though he grew up in South Dakota. Tom Daschle, you might remember, was nominated by Barack Obama to be Secretary of Health and Human Services late 2008, but his confirmation was, or his nomination, rather, was withdrawn. So Kristi would be the first South Dakotan to serve in the cabinet. We have had other South Dakotans take federal appointments.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned Governor Knipe resigned to be ambassador to Singapore. Governor Sigurd Anderson served on the Federal Trade Commission. Nils Boe, Governor Boe, worked in the White House and then was a judge on the Customs Court, Federal Customs Court. George T. Mickelson, who was governor in the 40s, the father of George S. Mickelson, he was the federal district judge here in Sioux Falls. So we've had several take federal appointments, but not at the cabinet level.
Yeah, and she would be the shortest tenured of any elected governor after the 1970s. Explain that to us.
The 1970s is when we went to four-year terms for the governor, which means that a two-term governor can serve 8 years.
Okay.
And so since the 70s, Dick Knipe was elected for an eight-year period, resigned about 5 months early, so he served, call it 7.5 years. Of course, his lieutenant governor, Harvey Wolman, finished that 5 months. Bill Janklow did 8 years and then came back for another 8 years, so 16 years. George Mickelson died in April of 1993, so he served 6 years and about 3 or 4 months. Walter Dale Miller, his lieutenant, finished out that last year and a half or so. And then Governor Rounds and Governor Dugard served 8 years. So Kristi Noem will be departing just days over 6 years that she'll have served out of the eight, which means Larry Roden would be serving just under 2 years.
So, and that brings us to how long could he serve then?
Mm-hmm.
He takes over, he takes the final 2 years. Can he get elected then twice and serve eight more years on top of this if he decided to run, which we don't know yet?
We don't know if he'll run again or not, but under our state constitution, you can be elected to two consecutive terms. So this partial term doesn't count. So in theory, he could do 2 years and then four and then four.
Will he have another inauguration, a calmer swearing in?
I would guess the best precedent for that is when Knipe resigned and Harvey Wolman took over. And they had a smaller ceremony on the steps of the Capitol. You know, most of the time the governor takes office in the winter. So the steps of the Capitol are not an attractive venue, but this was in July, and so I would guess it will be a ceremony, not on the scale of an inauguration with the inaugural ball and everything, but a nice ceremony.
Let's talk a little bit about Lieutenant Governor Larry Roden and some of the historic aspects of his personality, his spouse, children, background. You mentioned a small town that he is from that might be the smallest town that's produced a governor. Tell us a little bit about Larry Roden.
Yeah, I think Union Center is the smallest town. The Census Bureau doesn't count Union Center,
it's a very interesting blog
post. It's a little challenging to quantify, although the fact they don't count it tells you something. Well, Larry is from Meade County. He'll be the second governor from Meade County following Walter Dale Miller, who took over when George Mickelson died. Larry's background is in ranching, and he also has had a welding business. He'll only be the fifth West River governor. Of course, Walter Dale Miller was the last one. The others were all in the 30s and 40s. So West River governors are unusual in South Dakota. We haven't had one for a long time. His wife is Sandy. Sandy Murphy was her name, Roden. They have four sons. The only other governor to have four sons and no daughters was Arthur Millett, the first governor of South Dakota. So been waiting a long time for that. Interesting, I think. Both Larry Roden and Sandy Roden are twins.
I love this fun fact that you have.
I know, we're really reaching now. But as best I can tell, Larry's the first twin to be a South Dakota governor. He has a twin sister, fraternal twin sister. Sandy Rodin has an identical twin sister. So they're both twins.
Also, he's a veteran of the National Guard, which
is
fairly rare as well.
Just the third. Les Jensen, who was governor in the 1930s, and an impressive guy because he served in World War I before he was governor and then went back and served in World War II after he was governor. He was in MacArthur's headquarters in Australia during World War II.
Who was that again?
Leslie Jensen from Hot Springs.
I didn't know that, yeah.
So he was in the National Guard for a long time, and in fact, his statue and pier is in front of the Soldier Sailors Building, and he's wearing a World War I uniform, and that's why.
Okay.
The other is Joe Foss, who, of course, is very well known and was the Naval Aviator recipient of the Medal of Honor, but was one of the founders of the Air National Guard in South Dakota, and so he served in the Air National Guard as well as the Navy. And Larry would be just the third. So the governor is the commander-in-chief of the South Dakota National Guard. He'll be just the third commander-in-chief who has served in the South Dakota National Guard.
Yeah. How many lieutenant governors have gone on to be governor? Because this, again, you know, we're talking about Larry Roden's potential political future, which perhaps he's thought of extensively, and perhaps he is recalibrating as we speak. I have no idea. But how common is it for a lieutenant governor to then win election?
There have been seven lieutenant governors who have gone on to be elected governor. Governor Dugard is the most recent. There are two who have seceded to the governorship, Harvey Wallman and Walter Dale Miller, neither of whom went on to be elected. Larry Roden will be the third lieutenant governor to step up into the governorship. If he ran again and won, then he would be the eighth lieutenant governor to subsequently be elected.
Yeah. U.S. Senator John Thune now leading the Republican Senate. Is there precedent for that? We all know the answer to this question.
We all know the answer to that.
If you're new to the state, lay out who he defeated in what, 2004?
Yes, that's right. 20 years ago. So,
right, 20.
20 years ago this year, John Thune was elected to the Senate. He defeated Tom Daschle, who had been a three-term U.S. senator from South Dakota. And at the time, Daschle was the Democratic leader in the Senate. Daschle spent 10 years as the Senate Democratic leader in both majority and minority at different times. I think he flipped back and forth two or three times. That was, of course, a big deal at the time for the Democratic leader to be defeated. That's unusual. But it was also a big deal for South Dakota. Daschle was, and this is notable because John Thune and Tom Daschle will be the only two South Dakotans to reach that height in the Senate.
Yeah.
Daschle had been elected originally minority leader after the 1994 midterms. That was the big Newt Gingrich contract with America midterm. He became the Democratic leader of the Senate, reportedly by one vote, defeating Christopher Dodd from Connecticut. I held that position for 10 years, and for the first six of that would have been a governing partner to Bill Clinton, who was a Democrat. For the last four was really the primary foil to President George W. Bush, which is probably what did him in the end, was being the one of the national Democratic leaders in representing a Republican state. So John Thune defeated him in 2004. Now, 20 years later, he steps into that caucus position. He won that a little more comfortably than Daschle did, I think, by five
29
votes.
29 to 24 against John Cornyn.
Five votes. That's a big deal for South Dakota. It's also a big change for the country. Mitch McConnell, who he's replacing, is the longest-serving Senate leader in the history of the Senate, and so for either party. And he held that job for 18 years, almost all but two of the years that John Thune has been in the Senate. The Republican leader has been Mitch McConnell.
And unlike Tom Daschle, John Thune doesn't have a foreseeable challenger from the Democratic Party in his home state. So it's fairly...
Yeah, he's in a little more politically comfortable position because we're a Republican state and an increasingly Republican state, and he's the Republican leader. So there is always that contradiction with Tom Daschle that he had to balance, and that should not be as much of a problem for John Thune.
He's not up for election until 2028, so that also matters.
That's right. He has four years before he has to run again. And no, it's just...
He has a difficult job ahead.
Yes, it'll be a tricky 4 years.
Anybody in Washington has a difficult job right now, I think.
I think you could argue that South Dakota has maybe not had as much influence in the nation's capital as we're about to. Oh. Between having the Senate Majority Leader and Kristi Noem in the President's Cabinet, and Doug Burgum from North Dakota as Secretary of the Interior. I mean, the Dakotas are really punching above our weight. the next couple of years.
That is South Dakota Representative Tony Venhuizen. He writes the SODAC Governor's Blog, where you can find more of the historical breakdowns. We'll put a link up on our website at sdpb.org. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. SDSU political scientists David Wiltsy and Lisa Hager provide today's Dakota Political Junkies analysis. We're going to begin with U.S. Senator John Thune's rise to power. Then we'll discuss President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet appointments with hints on what to watch for when Congress decides how to navigate that confirmation process. David Wiltsy is a professor of political science, and Lisa Hager is an associate professor of political science, both at South Dakota State University, and they joined us from the SDPB Jeanine Basinger studio on campus in Brookings.
He is a seasoned senator, so I think it is natural that he would want to continue to elevate himself through Senate leadership. That's definitely always a goal that we see of members of Congress, is also trying to improve their own status within the chamber, in addition to obviously getting reelected and making what they perceive to be good public policy. But I think the other thing that's just noteworthy about Senator Thune is we've kind of seen things come full circle in terms of Daschle having that position and now Thune holding that position as well.
Yeah. Dr. Wiltsy, what would you add to that?
Most members of Congress care about rising through leadership, and most members of Congress care about policy. And Thune obviously is one of these folks. I mean, he's made a reputation for himself as someone who's both dedicated to the institution, dedicated to the policy process, and a good representative for the state of South Dakota, which distinguishes him from a lot of his colleagues on Capitol Hill, particularly on the House side. His career in the Senate has been pretty standard in terms of what we traditionally think of as the normal pathway and the incentives laid out for people who want to rise in the institution. Mm-hmm. And he's done that very well. I mean, you can't take anything away from his skills, both as a leader and as a legislator. You know, from day one, he was a very serious member of the Senate, and he's made a mark for himself and gained the respect of his colleagues along the way. And it speaks pretty highly of him that he's been able to do this in the time that he's been there.
Lisa, what does the Senate Majority Leader do?
Obviously, he is the leader of the floor, so he gets the opportunity to really be the first mover on things that are happening within the Senate. And so, in a more colloquial way of putting it, that's huge, obviously, given the way the Senate works and just being able to set the agenda. Thinking about what's going on with the Trump administration, having that control in the Senate from a partisan perspective will be huge for President Trump, his agenda. And I think, to Senator Thune's credit, bouncing off of what Dave said, he's always been very good at adeptly handling what's going on within the Republican Party, because that is something Trump's going to have to deal with, is that there's not always complete agreement there. And Thune's always been really good at kind of navigating what those more institutionalists want and what some of the other more right-wing folks are interested in.
In general, the Senate, it's not as hierarchical in terms of the leadership there. So it's not as if he's going to have the same kind of powers as Speaker Johnson does over on the House side. But when it comes to the agenda, when it comes to just putting things on the calendar, that's really where the majority leader can have an imprint. And clearly, that's going to be important, not just for all of these appointments, but for the legislative agenda as the next Congress unfolds in Trump's next term.
So, Lisa, where is the line between the Senate Majority Leader being the flag bearer for a president's agenda and also Congress's role of providing checks and balances against the executive branch?
So I think it's one of those things where we see the president often working with leadership in Congress, obviously having the same party as his control the Senate or the House or both is, of course, very important. But I think just the fact that we have these somewhat slim majorities in both chambers of Congress, and the fact that the Republicans do not always agree, that party leaders are going to have to be working to communicate to President Trump what they think will or will not be successful, and hopefully start bargaining and compromising even before things start percolating in those chambers.
And what I'm going to pay attention to is what kind of rule changes we might see in the Senate. Right now, as it stands, outside of judicial appointments and cabinet appointments and a few different kinds of appropriations, we still have the filibuster rule in place, the cloture rule in place. And we're going to see serious pressure to get rid of that. So it'll be easier for the president to get his legislative agenda through with that 54-53 seat majority they have.
Okay. So say more about that. And here's the general thing I'm wondering. American democracy can be plodding, as in slow. And some people are frustrated, like, you know, we don't have time to get things done. You know, there are these checks and balances, and that can make things move. And that traditionally was one of the frustrations that I think many people who want to send a businessman to Washington, you know, forget that it's not run like a business, but it's not a business. It's a government. And there are things, there are structures in place that will slow down some of those things. So what I'm hearing and what I'm understanding, and help me if I'm misunderstanding, is that some of these rule changes would speed the process up, but then they speed the process up for the person who comes after you as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if the opposing party is in office 4 years later, 8 years later, they also have a swifter, smooth path to enacting their agendas. So correct. I don't know if I have a question, more of a tangled mess in my mind. So as professors, what is this student really wondering?
Well, that's the thing with a lot of more institutionally oriented senators. They're thinking long term here. They're thinking exactly what you just said. Well, it might be expedient for me and my party at this particular moment in time, but what happens when we lose our narrow majority and there's a new narrow majority? What does that do for the ability of the minority to frustrate the process and force some kind of bargaining to be had? And up until now, the Senate has been very hesitant to loosen these rules. It's only been as the result of serious crises, whether it's appointing judges and getting their confirmation through, that they're willing to change these rules on cloture. But we are at a point, especially with the president who is going to try to squeeze every little bit of his mandate that he can, that Thune is going to have to seriously consider and deal with these kinds of pressures to change those rules.
Mm. Lisa, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I think what we're going to see is if they do decide to actually change Senate rules in terms of the cloture vote, we're going to see things similar to what Dave was talking about with the confirmation of judges. So with the nuclear option, where it just requires a simple majority to invoke cloture, you now have the situation where more extreme folks can find their way to the bench. And so we could see more extreme policies, or just, you know, whatever the president wants if he has control of the Senate, or his party does, I should say.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand what invoking cloture means.
So just where you have to have a vote to close debate in the Senate in order to consider the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, the cloture rule for most things is 60 senators.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a supermajority that's required. And, you know, like I said, they've just been changing this bit by bit, piece by piece, over time to react to specific pressures. We did it with district judges and appellate justices during the Obama administration, when there was this huge backlog of appointees not getting any consideration. And then the Republicans changed the rules they changed it so that they could get their Supreme Court judicial nominees through for President Trump. So it's going to be hard to predict what they'll do and where someone like Thune would draw the line.
Right. When we think of Mitch McConnell, we think of the U.S. Supreme Court and some of the things he was willing to do to enact an agenda that he wanted. And do we know what John Thune would have done as his right-hand man at the time? You know, was he saying, yes, I would have done that too, or would he have done something different? Yeah, again, it's hard to predict, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I'm also curious to know what the cabinet, so we're hearing these nominations, we're hearing these names thrown out, they're coming very quickly to us. Some of them are shocking to some people, some of them are exciting to some people. How important are these positions? Obviously, Governor Kristi Noem, been tapped to be Secretary of Homeland Security. We have Pete Hegseth for Secretary of Defense. He's a Fox News analyst and a combat veteran. Matt Gaetz, obviously, for Attorney General. How important are these roles and how do they work with Congress? How will John Thune handle directing how they're appointed or how they're confirmed, what their confirmation hearings are, but then also what are the consequences of, like, how closely are they going to work together? Lisa, government powers. you're teaching this. Let's start
yes,
with you.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
How does the cabinet work? These are not figureheads. These are people who make important decisions.
Right, yeah. So they're really directing the department that they are heading. And it really depends on the president, how much of a role these folks play within the administration when it comes to policy. What we've seen over time is a lot of presidents moving away from really relying on their cabinet a lot and trying to centralize things as much as possible within the White House and relying more on White House staffers for a lot of the advice that they need relating to the policy areas that are under the jurisdiction of the departments. And so there's a variety of different reasons for that, but a lot of times this concern that, you know, you have these folks with expertise or just this general interest in that particular policy area of the cabinet, that they may get captured, so to speak, by the, you know, career bureaucrats and really kind of have their own minds with respect to what should happen on that policy area rather than thinking more nationally like the president, where he has to balance all of these different policy areas. He definitely is putting more politically minded folks in those positions. So again, that can kind of change what typically tends to happen. Trump is always the exception, I feel like I'm saying when I'm teaching students about stuff, but some of the stuff still applies.
The bureaucracy is self-sustaining in some ways. The bureaucracy supports itself. How difficult would it be for an American president, Professor Wiltsie, to make meaningful and drastic change in those federal employees in civil service? Can someone really come in and fire a bunch of people and put in political appointees? Bureaucracy is there for a reason, and part of that reason is protective.
It would take cooperation with Congress, because Congress is going to have to write a lot of civil service law in order to do the kind of transformative things that Trump wants to do to the bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. But that's not out of the range of feasibility right now. They could, depending on how well he can manage his political capital. But as far as reclassifying employees and these sorts of things, it's not something he can do on his own. Okay. He can certainly shake things up. They can make life very miserable for career bureaucrats and kind of incent them to leave and refill them, kind of backfill those positions with new classifications like they tried to do towards the end of Trump's first term. Mm-hmm. So there's things that he can do more than just on the margins, but in terms of just wholesale changes to the bureaucracy, that's going to take cooperation with Congress.
I'm having a hard time imagining what the potential Secretary of Defense, who doesn't think women should be in combat positions in the U.S. military, I can't, you know, having been in the military, I can't imagine how you would change that. That would be an incredibly difficult policy to enact for operational readiness because of the number of women who are already doing these jobs and are in leadership. They have stars on their collars, some of these women. That would be a really difficult thing to go back on. How hard is it to go back on things or to change things that are entrenched?
It can be difficult depending on the source of that particular mandate. So like we were talking about earlier, where if Trump wants to completely restructure the structure of the bureaucracy, you know, you need a lot of help from Congress. So you often need a lot of help from Congress on a lot of these things. It just depends what it is that they're doing. You know, it might be something where they're implementing policy and it's more from the rulemaking perspective. So then they're going to be doing new rulemaking, but we still have procedures about how rulemaking works.
Right.
So, you know, it can be difficult. And I think one thing we're going to see is that it may sound good to say some of these things early on, and then when you really get into it and you start to see, you know, what is or isn't practical, we might see some things kind of getting scaled back.
Yeah. Sure.
And with him in particular, I'd really be surprised if he survives this nomination process.
Yeah.
I mean, this was just one of those off-the-wall appointments that it's clear that it's some kind of loyalty test. Again, kind of roping back to what we talked about with John Thune, this is the president basically throwing down and saying, go ahead, stop me if you dare.
And that's what we're all waiting for. What will John Thune do next? What will he try to stop, and what will he open the door for? He has a lot of power right now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, he does. Yeah. And again, you know, we can't peer into his mind.
Right.
The Senate is not exactly your most transparent institution there is, especially when it comes to the scheduling of hearings, you know, whether it be at the committees or the ultimate vote on the Senate floor. Who knows what's going to happen with some of these off-the-wall nominations. But I would guess things like Rubio, Borgum, Noem, these are going to fly through. Mm-hmm. These are very normal appointments. Some people might not like these individuals, but when it comes right down to it, these are run-of-the-mill appointments that you would expect from any president.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, if you are a longtime listener, you might recognize the voice of Gordy Pratt on our airwaves. Pratt, a resident of Spearfish, wrote and performed his brand of stand-up musical comedy since 1990 across the Black Hills. He created the Deadwood Production Company and produced 12 historical shows, which were performed more than 3,000 times. Gordy Pratt passed away last week. So let's take a look back at some of the comedy, music, and historical interpretations he shared with SDPB over a few years. We're going to begin in 2016.
The Custer Expedition said there's gold here to be found. Come one, come all, your fortunes can be picked up off the ground. The times were tough, the drought was rough, the Great Depression roared. Middle Western pioneers, well, they were mostly unemployed. The prospect of a gold rush gave them hope to cure their ills. They hugged the wife, kissed the kids, and headed for the hills. It was the gold rush of 76, Dakota was the cry. In 1876 we came, some stayed, some left, some died. Those were the days the West was wild, we mined with pans and picks. And Deadwood made its mark in time in the days of 76.
Performer Gordy Pratt has stepped into the persona of Deadwood legend Seth Bullock in front of a live audience 1,000 times as of this afternoon. That was Pratt performing the opener for the show Seth Bullock, The Spirit of the West. He's played the tune on Good Morning America, and he's played it for thousands of audience members, bringing to life a man known for bringing law and order to the violent chaos of early Deadwood. In honor of Pratt's 1,000th Seth Bullock show, we sat down with Gordy and his guitar in the SDPB studios in Rapid City. Sometimes when you ask Gordy a question, Seth takes over. You'll see what I mean. First, we talked about the genesis of the Seth Bullock show.
I wrote Seth for Mary Schmidt, who renovated the Bullock Hotel in 1994. She said, why don't you write a show about Seth? Because, of course, Seth was really hot then. He was on Unsolved Mysteries, and there was a lot of hoopla about Seth. So we wrote the Seth show. And then I left Deadwood and really didn't perform it that much until the Adams Museum started. 11 years ago, I started doing three shows a day, which just happened to be, about a year after the Deadwood HBO series hit. So it was all PR, you know, top of mind awareness of Seth.
That was Gordy Pratt talking about his one-man show, Seth Bullock, Spirit of the West. Well, I talked with Gordy again in 2018, this time with his writing and performing partner, Dallas Sellers. I was in Rapid City for this one, and I remember there was snow, a lot of snow, and I wasn't sure that he and Dallas would make it to the studio, but of course they did. They came early. They came ready to sing.
I met Dallas in Spearfish. I started a song circle about a dozen years ago, where people just get together on a Saturday afternoon, sit around in a circle and round robin play songs.
Yeah.
And I hadn't been there for a long time. And I went, and here was this new person. I thought, oh, who's that? And she sang a song. I went, who's that?
Yeah, and then he played classical gas, and I was like, who's that?
And I had a project that I wanted to work on, a cowboy show for the Western Heritage Center in Spearfish. And here comes Dallas. So we decided, well, first I said, we got together and had a meeting about this project. I said, do you know how to yodel? Because it's cowboy music. And she said, no, but I can learn. And the next day, about 8:45 in the morning, I got a little a voice thingy on my phone, my text thing, and it was her yodeling. And then I had picked these three
yodels.
She's
a quick study.
Quick study, yeah.
And yodeling in harmony is a whole different deal than just yodeling. I had three yodels picked out, and I was kind of having a tough time with them. And Dallas comes to rehearsal the next day, and they're all written out in musical notes with the syllables above them. I said, would you like to be the musical director of this project? And she said, yes.
Well, he's classically trained, so of course, why wouldn't you just do notation? And, I mean, I knew that's fabulous. How I could get him to understand how to sing it, so it worked out nice.
Yeah. So anyway, that's how I had a project in the offing, so we really got to explore each other's skill sets professionally, not only performing. Dallas is a tremendous performer, but what I don't think she knew is she also has a good head for writing. There's a lot of narrative in this show, and it really tries to get to the prove the thesis that there's a little cowboy in all of us. It's mm-hmm. called The Spirit of the American Cowboy. There's a little cowboy in all of us.
Did you know what you were getting into, Dallas?
Oh, gosh, no, that's a great question, too. That is so true, because, I mean, I've only performed musically. I've never done any sort of stand-up. And, I mean, he does stand-up. It's with music and stuff, but it's still comedy.
I call it stand-up musical comedy.
Yeah, and you have to, like, memorize words and everything. And so, yeah, it was really a challenge for me. And I hadn't played professionally for the last 30 years. I just put it away when I got married and had done music with church. And
you were a rocker. You still are a rocker.
Yeah, rock on. And member of the Iowa Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And so, you know, I just, yeah, I didn't know what I was getting into. It was tough. It was tough.
Give us a little taste. What would you like to play first for us?
This is the opening song from the Spirit of the American Cowboy. There's a little cowboy in all of us. There's different kinds of cowboys. Working cowboys. Yeah. Rodeo cowboys.
Yeehaw.
Drugstore cowboys. Urban cowboys, midnight cowboys, and even ragtime cowboys. Out in West Dakota where the Badlands are, and the only thing that got you is an evening star.
The roughest, toughest man by far is ragtime cowboy Joe.
Got his name from singing to the cows and sheep.
Every night they say he sings her to sleep.
In a lonely tree,
singing soft and low,
so as not to arouse the cow,
so as not to disturb the herd.
Don't want to rattle the cattle. He always sings raggedy music to the cattle as he swings back and forward in the saddle on a horse. What a horse! A syncopated gator and such a funny meter to the roar of his repeater. How they run when they hear the fellas' guns, because the western folks all know he's a highfalutin', rootin', tootin' son of a gun from West Dakota, ragtime cowboy Joe.
I'm an old cow hand from Dakota land, and I learned to ride before I learned to stand. I'm a riding fool who's up to date. I know every trail in the Rushmore State, cause I drive the range in a Ford V8.
Yippee-i-o-ki-yay,
hey,
yippee-i-o-ki-yay.
I'm an old cow hand.
We're old cow hands
from Dakota land.
From Dakota land, and we come to town just to hear the band.
We know all the songs that the cowboys know about the big corral where the goldies go,
because we learned them all on the radio.
Yippee-i-o-ki-yay, yippee-i-o-ki-yay.
Everybody, yippee-i-o-ki-yay. One more time. Yippee-i-o-ki-yay.
He always
sings raggedy music music to the cattle as he swings back and forward in his saddle on a horse that is syncopated. It's such a funny meter to the roar of his repeater. How they run when they hear the fellas guns, because the western folks all know he's a hoffalootin', rootin', tootin' son of a gun from West Dakota, ragtime cowboy.
I cannot express how fulfilling it is to perform and to have a partner like Gordy. We're like, we've always
known. Who goes out and
gets
the work.
Yeah, he gets the work. All I have to do is show up. It's kind of like being a princess. And I love it. And he's just so fun to be around. And he's always trying out things on you. So it's never boring.
Bipolar, table for two.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And, you know, and it's just, it's been so fulfilling for me. And it's so, I'm so glad to be back at it. And, you know, we're not exactly spring chickens, either one of us.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So it's really thrilling, actually.
Yeah. And Gordy playing with a partner after, you know, so much solo work.
I was got so sick of playing with myself, I can't tell you. It's such a pleasure. Such a pleasure.
Oh, my.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I work by myself because I make a living at it, and that's the way I could keep the most money, basically. I do everything. I booked it. I do the lights. I do the sound. Write the material, all this. But to all of a sudden have a partner, what I didn't realize, I thought, oh, you got a guitar and a voice, so those are the tools you have. When you add somebody like Dallas who has those skills, and it brings a lot of other skills, too, the most important is Dallas is one of those performers who is absolutely fearless. Which you don't find that often. I'm not a fearless performer. It's just been a little piece of heaven at my advanced age. I'm awfully thankful, I tell you that.
There's been a couple times where I've faltered and I've forgotten words. You know, I'm getting up there in age and I forget words. And I just, as I like to say, I start speaking in tongues. And Gordy's like, I don't know how you pulled out of that. How did you? And you ended up where you were supposed to be. It's like, well, you got to keep...
I stop and apologize. That's my thing. Oh, geez, I'm sorry. Okay, here we go. Now I got it.
So is that what fearless means? Define fearless.
Fearless
in a performing
performer.
Partner. Yeah.
Who's a performer, you should understand this. You are fearless in the way that you approach an interviewee.
Yes.
You're not afraid to say anything, but you're smart enough sensitive enough to say it in the right way so it's not offensive. I mean, if you're you got 2,000 people sitting in front of you, to try something new, is really fearless. I rehearse. I know exactly what I'm going to do, and that's what I do. And if I don't screw it up, it usually goes pretty well. People laugh, they cry, and they laugh so hard they cry, which is my motto. Dallas just goes for it. It's fascinating. Yeah.
Has she changed you as a performer, being with her? This show?
It is changing me, yeah. For one thing, I just get to play some guitar. I don't have to be everything all the time. I just get to be a side man.
And he was so driven to, when we first got together, everything had to be, no, click it. It's got to go faster. So for us to do like a legato kind of song, a slow song, really stepping out for him to bring it down and let it relax.
Yeah.
And I have to share stage time, too, which... I'm not used to.
South Dakota's fabulous original one guy, Gordy Pratt, passed away on November 13th. He was 71. Funeral services are anticipated in the spring. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. We leave you with a little more music from Gordy Pratt. From all of us at STPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.